Hello and welcome to episode 14 of D50 Shades of D&D. With me, I have my partners in crime, Rick
Hey, everybody.
and James.
Hey, how's it going?
Not to be confused with Rick James.
Yeah, bitch.
And today is kind of a special treat and a little out of the ordinary for us as we talk about The Eyes Beyond the Torchlight role-playing game. Rick, would you like to tell everybody why this episode is a little different than our other episodes?
This is a I don't know if I've ever had to make a full disclosure before on one of our shows, so this is a first. I bought the publishing rights to the game Beyond the Torchlight, the role-playing game. I did not write it, but I was a fan of it. I correspond. Do people say that still? If you just chat a whole lot online with someone, are you corresponding with them? But I chat a lot with Scott, the guy, Scott Myers, the guy that created the game. And when he suggested that he might be willing to, I the day before that, I had zero inclination or idea that I would be buying the publishing rights to a role-playing game. And then within 24 hours, I own the publishing rights to a role-playing game. So I'm over the moon about it. I love it. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
That's awesome.
So,
Congratulations.
in a
Thanks.
surprisingly multi-million dollar deal, did you have to have investors join in with you?
They've asked me not to to reveal. So
Well, yeah, Bezos can be like that.
there's a group out at based out of Belize that has joined me.
Nice,
they're
nice.
You know, Justin has his believers. I have my Belizers. And yes,
So,
that on the fly.
I have played this game with you in the meantime. James
Yeah.
has not.
Not yet. I'm totally
So why
new.
don't you tell the world what is the gist of Eyes Beyond the Torchlight?
So I don't think it's too radically different from a shade of D&D, like all the other games that we've discussed. It is definitely not a retro clone. I don't think it's really a clone at all, but there is plenty there that I think if you've played any of the shades of D&D, you would quickly be able to pick this up and run with it. It's more of it's kind of a summation of its parts. And it is, you know, Scott took the games I think that he liked best, and he took the parts from those games that he liked best, and he made a Frankenstein. Castles and Crusades, which we have covered, was a big influence. Scott loves Castles and Crusades. Savage Worlds, which we won't cover on this podcast because it's not really a shade of D&D, but there was elements of Savage Worlds, which he also really likes, that he took it. And he put that into the mix. Not everything by any means, you know, just some key parts that if you've ever been even remotely familiar with Savage Worlds, you'll see them. A couple other games, including 13th Age, which is a shade, and Barbarians of Lemuria, which is again not really a shade of D&D, but you know, another game that he liked. He just sort of cherry picked from all those different systems and kind of like, you know, put it together like a stew, and that became Eyes Beyond the Torchlight.
So as I glance through it definitely has the look and feel of a lot of the OSR games that it's definitely in that vein and that flavor. It had
Yeah,
great I
there's
love great artwork and I love the art design in it. But I do notice, the biggest difference and the biggest nod to Savage Worlds, it looks like, is the character attributes.
absolutely. Absolutely. That is the main, number one on the artwork. I am also a big fan of it. I'm thrilled that the artwork came with it. Todd, you're Todd. Scott essentially took a lot of public domain stuff, and he digitally altered it. Scott is an artist in his own right. He is his day job is a tattoo artist, and he took all this artwork that was available for public use, and he kind of digitally altered it and made it his own. And that gives it, I feel, a consistent look from cover to cover.
Definitely.
To address
all of the art definitely has like a same art direction vibe.
I don't always, I don't mind it when a game goes from like something that looks like a painting, like almost like from a historical painting of like knights and arms and armor to like a line art cartoon, like, the DMG did, the original one.
Oh, yeah.
Or yeah. DCC also like honored that with its books and its artwork. So I don't mind that at all, but I also kind of like it when it is consistent from cover to cover. And that's definitely something that Eyes Beyond the Torchlight does. But to address your the Savage Worlds statement that you had, very much so, that the biggest influence from Savage Worlds is probably the way attributes or traits work, in the sense that rather than provide a static bonus, like a +1/+2 to your D20 roll, because the game does use a D20. I guess we should also get that established. But so if you're going to try to hit someone with a weapon, like specifically a melee, you're going to roll your D20, but you're also going to roll your brawn die, and brawn reflects your character's strength or constitution. So if you have a brawn die of a D6, you would roll that along with your D20, add the two together, and that would give you a result. The target number, by the way, is always 12. So if you get a 12 or higher with those two dice combined, then, likely you have hit your target. If it's a more powerful target, there might be a modifier that would make it, more than 12. But that's essentially.
So instead of like traditional D&D, and D20 based games, instead of having a static bonus to your rolls, you're actually using a die type. So yeah, instead of just getting a +2, you're getting a +D4. Instead of a +3, you're getting a +D6, right?
Like the starting character, the lowest die type that they will have to add. Like, so if you're coming up, there's a if you're creating a wizard, or in the terminology of the game, we call them mages. So if you're creating a mage, much like in other forms of D&D, strength is not really a key ability for a mage. So you might stick a D4 in that. Character creation is very simple. You start with an array, and the array is a D4, two D6s, and a D8. There's four traits, and so you take those four dice, change them to taste, or you can put a D6 in everything. So it's either the D4, the two D6s, or all D6s. So as a mage, you might put the D4 in your strength. Now, you don't have to. You can be a strong mage if you want to, but most are going to like favor their intellect as a mage. That's kind of like your intelligence in D&D terms. So you're going to put probably your weakest die into strength or into brawn, rather, which, by the way, is kind of like an trait that combines both your strength and your constitution. And you would give that a D4. So even when a mage swings like his staff or whatever, he is going to roll the D20 and a D4. So that's potential four points added to that D20 roll rather than a +2. Now, your target's a little higher in D&D, or like since third edition anyway, they base it off of like a 10 or higher is usually a success, depending on like if your foe is unarmored, it does not have a dexterity modifier, you get a 10 or higher. Well, in this game, it's a 12 or higher. So
So it's scaled to work. And there are four attributes instead of six?
There are four. As I mentioned, they took, he kind of combined both strength and constitution to become brawn. And he combined both wisdom and charisma to be presence. The other two, like agility, works exactly like dexterity, and intellect works exactly like intelligence. Again, because the nature of our show being about shades of D&D, I'm keeping it in D&D terms, but that's essentially exactly how it works. So like your presence is not only your wisdom, it's your charisma. It's all those, what's the word I'm looking for? Intangibles, mental intangibles. So if you're not sure if it's mental, but you're not exact, and you know it's not intelligent, well then, you know, obviously it's presence. Just like if it involves any kind of like grace or movement, typically to be able to be accurate, it's going to be agility and everything else, be it strength, be it like withstanding stuff, being it resisting stuff, it's going to be brawn.
Nice. So the thing I love about the extra die assigned to an attribute is that like, one of the most fun things about a role-playing game is rolling dice, right? So this idea that you're rolling more dice is like more fun, right? Like,
top of that, the system features something called, let me make sure I get it, like boosts and hindrances, which are like, so if the situation would warrant getting a bonus, maybe because of a spell, maybe because of what you have, like an edge, which are a little bit like feats from D&D third era, but simpler, you know, definitely not as, you know, meta as those things got. They're another influence from Savage Worlds, as a matter of fact, but you might get an additional D6 that you can roll on top of everything else. So say, go back to that example of having the D6 brawn, you roll the D20 all the time. The D20 gets rolled every single time. You also roll the attribute or the, you know, the D6 for that. And then you finally, if in certain situations, you might be rolled an extra D6. So you add all those together to come up with your final total. Of course, there's also the negative side in situations where you might be penalized. You might have to roll that extra D6 and actually subtract it from your total rather than add it. Or if you're adverse to like, well, I don't want to do both addition and subtractions in my games, so just roll that D6 and add it to the target number or the threat number rather than rather than subtract, and it works equally the same.
So that's an interesting point. And another thing, again, I'm brand new to this game, so I'm just flipping through the book and kind of noting interesting things that stick out. But the one that sticks out pretty clearly is that this is a players roll all the dice game, huh?
Yep. It is player facing. So with very few exceptions, there are a few. But with very few exceptions, the players roll off. So in combat, for example, because combat is so frequent in these games, the players, assuming they win initiative, are going to be rolling to like to hit their foes, to strike their foes, to cast spells at their foes, and so forth. And then they'll turn right around, and then they will roll to dodge or resist. It's not like I have a static result as the game master. I have a static result for the monsters or the NPCs, and the players are rolling to avoid the damage or to dodge the damage or resist the damage. So they do all the rolls. Most people really enjoy it because so they feel like it puts the power in their hands. You know, if they get hit, it's because they didn't roll well enough rather than, you know, so, man, that DM fudging because he's hit me like the last three rounds in a row.
Can't hide from yourself.
Exactly.
So that's how Numenera works, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the dice roll that way.
I'll be honest, I have Numenera, but I don't think I've ever played it, but I do have it, and I liked what I saw. It's just with all the other games that I have, it just hasn't gotten to my table yet.
Also, yeah. If you play D&D with Tim Kask and he hits you with a fireball, he makes you roll the damage.
That's awesome.
Yeah, which is beautiful.
going back to the like, there's more dice to roll and it's more fun. Like, yeah, this is another opportunity for you to touch dice, which is some of the most fun that you have as a player. The thing that I've loved about Players Roll All the Dice games is also often when I'm DMing, I need a second to like think about what am I going to do next? What am I like, and to respond. And if the players are focused on rolling dice, that gives the DM a break to think about what you're going to throw at them next or respond, and really allows you to focus on DMing than it does, you know.
It's dirt simple to modify too. So if but beyond offering like the boost die or the hindrance die, like the extra D6s that I already mentioned, other than doing that, you can also have them, you know, bump them up the dice chain, much like in DCC. So if they normally get their brawn is a normal D6, but they're specialized in their weapon, you know, they can roll a D8 instead of a D6. Or, you know, if the situation, like if you have a shield when you're defending, you get to, you know, it's typically an agility roll. So if your agility is a D6, but you have a shield, you roll D8 instead.
Nice. So that's a different approach to the advantage disadvantage kind of mechanic that people often include in games these days. Instead of rolling one die twice, you just get a larger die up the chain. I like that.
I love that you bring up advantage disadvantage, because if anything, it resembles more Shadow of the Demon Lord than mm-hmm. it does D&D 5th edition, because Shadow of the Demon Lord is yet another influence on the game. Scott's a big fan of, and you know, I certainly.
Yeah, okay. I see the connection now.
Rob Schwalb's Shadow of the Demon Lord.
Very awesome.
So Rick, sorry, James, go ahead.
I was just going to ask.
Less pooping, though. Less defecation than Shadow of the Demon Lord. But
oh, okay.
As the GM, if you want to bring that shit in. No pun. Well, yeah, pun very much intended. You certainly can.
That's a very important point, Rick. Getting into like the Shadow of the Demon Lord part, that makes me think of like you really, really dove into Shadow of the Demon Lord early on, I remember, and were a huge fan. And it seems like really, really dove into this game as well, so much that you are an owner now.
Yep.
What was it about Eyes Beyond the Torchlight that said to you, like, I have to get in on this. I want this to be my game, essentially.
Simply that from the time that I first was introduced to role-playing games with Dungeons & Dragons in 1979, I wanted to make my own game. I wanted to, like, either make my own, you know, hack before we were calling it hacks. I wanted to, like, you know, come up with my own version, you know, and other than house rules over the years, I think I got one hack of DCC, specifically a superhero hack of DCC to the playtest stage, where I did public playtests of it at some of like the DCC days. But that's as far as I ever got, and that kind of fell apart after that. So, I mean, here I was. I started when I was, like, in high school, and I just turned 58 earlier this month, and I was no closer to creating my own game, so I bought one instead. And, again, like I mentioned earlier in the show, I really hadn't really thought about doing that until it, like, fell into my lap. The opportunity literally – well, not literally, but very figuratively, fell into my lap. And I just decided, you know, yeah, I'm going to do this.
That's awesome.
Scott just, I mean, he's kind of like, you know, we have similar taste in games. I'd like to think that, you know, I like the parts that he took from all those games. And I like that he, like, ignored some of the parts that I don't like from those games. So it's just, it's like, I guess any game these days is kind of like a stew. And I really like the stew that is Eyes Beyond the Torchlight.
So now that you've entered the high stakes world of role-playing game publishing, do you feel like you will kind of become the Hugh Hefner of the gaming industry?
Well, I think I'm already there, Todd. Come on. I got the.
I think you need a nicer bathrobe.
No, I mean, I don't know if I'll ever like buy another game. I mean, never say never again. I didn't think I would do this until I actually did it. So I'm content having this be my game. And, you know, but, you know, who knows? Scott's got other games, and I have semi-kiddingly offered, like, so what do you want for that one? But so far he's sitting on the, and he's got other things he's working on. But
right.
You never know. Or, like, you know, I've considered, like, you know, people like Eric Bloat, friend of the show. Eric's got that program where you can take his game and basically file the serial numbers off it and publish it, and all you got to do is give Eric credit, you know, that this is, these rules were a part of it's his it's that Transformers game of his, what's it called?
Valor Knights,
exactly, which is a badass title, by the way. But you can basically take that game, you can buy it as, I think it's a Word file or something like that, you copy and paste it into your own browser or whatever design program. You change the words that as necessary, and then you can publish it as your own game. So I thought that eventually I might like pursue that as well. It'd be a difference.
We need to get Eric. We need to get Eric on the show.
Eric should definitely be on the show.
Although the way he cranks out games, I don't know if he'd have time to be on our show.
Eric's kind of a role model for me. So I'd be extremely happy if one day that I had like the body of work that Eric has.
I think when he sees the luxury accommodations that we offer for being on the show, I think he'd really be able to turn us down.
Yeah. And the swag bag is pretty nice.
Yeah. I did see him at Origins, and I was able to get past his bodyguards long enough to say hey to him for a little bit.
Speaking of the swag bags, have we upgraded for the Oculus? Have we got the latest version of the Oculus in there for our guests? Are we still offering like that tired old, you know, or the new Meta headset? I think we should throw one of those in there.
The headset that we offer in the swag bag is definitely Meta. but I hear the swag bag will come now with a copy of Eyes Beyond the Torchlight.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought the headset was a trucker hat.
Just says keep on trucking.
Yes.
But at some point, I guess I should mention where folks can find Eyes Beyond the Torchlight. It's on Drive-Thru RPG. You know, just put in Eyes Beyond the Torchlight and it'll come right up. That is strictly PDF right now, but very soon we should also have it as a print on demand. But speaking of print, you can get it on Amazon.com. Everybody knows Amazon, and it should come up as both a soft cover and a hard cover. I think they're pretty reasonably priced for like I think it's a 216 page book, 218 page book, all black and white, glossy cover. And then speaking of print, you can also get it on Lulu as a coil-bound softcover, which is my personal favorite. I just love the fact that, you know, a coil-bound book lays flat on the table, and it's got a really nice F to it. I didn't chintz out on it. I used the best paper that they offered. It's the paper they typically use for color printing. But I used it, even though it's a black and white book, I wanted the best paper. And I was just so pleased when my author copies came in. I was able to pick it up out of the box. It's like, oh, it feels so great. And it's definitely my favorite of the three. And it's very reasonably priced right now at $19.99.
And I think we should let our listeners know that if they approach you at a convention or a game store with a coil-bound copy to autograph, you are much more likely to accommodate them and not have your goons beat them up.
Yeah. I don't know if you'll catch me at many conventions upcoming, but you might.
he's hard to catch at conventions.
Might be able to find me, you know, Next Round Games, which is my FLGS in Cincinnati, Ohio. come by on Saturdays. Pretty much like, oh, sorry.
Or they can catch you on the beach in one of your many luxury vacations that you've been taking.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, you know, we are going, we're staying at the mountains this time. We're staying at a cabin in the mountains this coming weekend. But then, yeah, come April, we'll be right back out the beach after we just got back a couple weeks ago. But yeah, I'm at that age where, you know, I can't spend enough time at like the mountains or the beach. So
when you're...
those lucrative profits from now being a game publisher.
Yeah, man, I'm just rolling.
It doesn't hurt.
So when you're staying in the mountains, do you find yourself fighting off a lot of supernatural threats like John the Balladeer?
This is my first time to stay in the mountains. So I'm a beach guy. This was Christy's idea. So we will see. I'd be kind of disappointed if there's not a little bit of that, you know.
Be sure to put silver strings on your guitar.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll have to get a guitar to get silver strings to put on it.
I'll loan you one.
Yeah. Between you guys, I need an instrument. If you remember, and you know, if this podcast was ZZ Top, I am definitely Frank Beard. So that's silver drumsticks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Get some silver drumsticks.
There you go. So speaking of John the Balladeer, and kind of makes me think of magic. And I have like some questions, having never played this.
Sure.
There's common things we always, you know, look at when we evaluate these games.
Yep.
One of them being, how does magic work? Like, how do I cast Magic Missile and what does it do?
Okay. Okay. So the spells, Scott took for spells is, if I can bring monsters into it for a second, the approach he took and the approach he took with spells are very different. The approach he took for monsters is it's got well over 150 monsters statted up for it. They are, the stat blocks are very, very reasonable. They can fit on a business card, at most an index card, but most can fit on a business card. As a matter of fact, the pages of the book that are devoted to monsters, there's 50 or 60 of them, I think. Most of them fit three monsters per page, and with room for some occasional artwork. Not every monster is illustrated. I mean, Scott didn't have time to do them all. But just enough to like to keep it from becoming just page after page of text and text. And again, there's not a whole lot of text per monster. They're all the classic ones that you remember from the Monster Man, you know, the AD&D era of Monster Manual 1 and Monster Manual 2, even the Fiend Folio. Of course, the copyrighted ones or the IP protected ones are not there, but there's so many others that you could easily sort of like eyeball them and convert them. More than likely on the fly, but one day I'd like to offer like maybe a free download that has those, you know, maybe the IP protected ones with the serial numbers filed off. So an eye tyrant or, you know,
I was going to say, speaking of eyeballing it, you,
that was unintentional. That was, but, the whole reason I brought up monsters is because, so the approach he took on monsters was, there's no such thing as too many, you know, for a one volume book to put in well over 150 monsters and have room for all the rules and the, you know, the other GM stuff like magic items. There's an entire setting in there. There's even an introductory adventure. It all fits in there in 216 or so pages. And I think it, you know, not many games, I think. I'll put my game up against anybody as far as like the amount of monsters that it offers. Yeah. But approach with
is bring, like, bring your A game, people.
Exactly. You know, and, you know, if you do have a game that does it better, please tell me what it is so I can buy your game because, you know, I love games. I'm very polygamerous. That term is trademarked, you know, so don't use it. But, you know, I think you can figure out what it means. But again, the approach to spells was the opposite way. He tried to, like, come up with, like, universal powers. They're called powers in the game, but they're clearly spells. But if you did use it to run, like, say, in another genre, you might call it something like that, like psionic powers or superpowers or whatever. But they're called powers, but they're essentially spells. And so Magic Missile in particular would run off of a spell called Bolt. And basically, so it's a mage-only power. So it works off of intellect, as you might imagine. So to strike someone with your bolt, it's not an auto hit like Magic Missile in other games.
Oh, wow.
Or it is, but it isn't. And I'll explain that in a second, because spellcasting can both be Vancian and non-Vancian. The way it probably typically works is that you would roll your d20, your mage would roll your d20, and you would roll your intellect die. So let's say you have a d8 in your intellect die. So you roll the two of those, and again, your target number is 12 or higher. Depending on the threat number of the monster, like, you know, a goblin is going to be like a threat number 1. But an ogre might be a 4 or a 5. Those get added on or subtracted from the roll. It's your choice. Either one works. So like a threat number threat number 5 creature would be a 17 or higher rather than a 12 or higher. If you're familiar with Castles and Crusades, this should sound very familiar.
Yeah.
If you hit, you basically look at your intellect die, and whatever the result of the intellect die is your damage. So again, if you had that D8, if you wound up getting a 6 added to whatever you rolled on your D20, and it was in the event of the ogre, if it was a 17 or higher, whatever you got on your intellect die, that's essentially your damage. So if you got a 6, you did 6 points of damage. If you rolled a 1, but say you rolled super well on your D20, you rolled like a 19 on your D20, but you only rolled a 1 on your intellect, then you've done that, you know, tragic missile. You know, you've done 1 point of damage.
I love that. I've never heard that before, tragic missile.
Oh, I got that. I play every Friday night with Bob Brinkman, and I think I first picked that up from him. And so it's become part of my vocabulary. Now, let's say that you weren't happy with that. At the start of the session, in every session, every player gets 5 hero points. And one of the uses for a hero point is to add a D8 to anything. So if you said, you know what, I'm going to spend one of my hero points, I'm going to roll a D8, and hopefully you got like something decent and you can add that onto the damage. And of course, you can do that, you know, much like spending luck in DCC, you can do that after the results are revealed. So you can always just spend a hero to like, you know, beef that up a bit. You can even go crazy and use multiple hero points. But remember, once you've used 5, they're gone. But they don't carry over to the next session, so you might as well use them if you got them.
Very awesome. Use them or lose them. I love it.
The goal is to make people feel like they're heroic. You know, so a you know, there's no levels in Eyes Beyond the Torchlight, but a starting character is going to feel pretty powerful compared to, say, like an AD&D first edition, or maybe even a third edition. Character, maybe comparable to a fifth edition character. I haven't really done the math, but you know, it's a you can be quite competent as a starting character in Eyes Beyond the Torchlight, or EBTT as we call it.
Rick, it looks like when we move on to the ancestries and archetypes, we really get into familiar territory with the ancestries being dwarf, elf, gnome, halfling, half elf. Elf, half orc, and human.
Again, this was Scott's doing, but that's exactly what I would have done because I'm an AD&D 1E guy. Those are the 7 that were offered in AD&D 1E, and there have always been, you know, I feel if a game doesn't offer that many, they're not offering enough. If a game offers more than that, they're too many. So I love that those 7 are the ones that are available.
Well, and then the archetypes are a little more like a throwback to basic D&D.
It is the 4 temples. So, you know, the warrior, the mage, the rogue, and the cleric.
Yeah.
But if you by choosing various edges and hindrances, you can sort of like tailor them personally. So if you want to play a ranger, it's almost obvious, like which edges that you would choose to make him a ranger. If you want to play a paladin, same thing. If you want to play a paladin, it's all there. Scott had that in mind when he created the game. So it's, as a matter of fact, one of the first things I did once I bought it is to create, I think it wound up being like 17 or 18 different pregens. And with my pregens, I had in mind in recreating, like, so I wanted a, you know, a human ranger. I wanted a human, a paladin. I wanted an illusionist. I even went into the UA. So I you know, I made a thief acrobat. I made a cavalier. I made a barbarian. So, you know, and it was almost, it's like, I don't know. I think Scott had that in mind when he created the game. It was so obvious, like which edges to choose to do that. And if you don't want to do any of that, if you want to do something completely or mix and match, you can certainly do that as well. Edges are available to characters from beginning characters on. And as you earn advancement points, which is kind of like the game's experience points, for every 5 AP that you can spend, you can pick up a new edge, or you can grab couple new spells or powers, as they may be, if you're a spellcasting character. If you're not a spellcasting character, you can buy an edge that allows you to cast a single spell. So if you want to play Fofford and the Grey Mouser, and you want your Grey Mouser, you know, to be a rogue that can cast the occasional spell, it's dirt simple to do so.
So a litmus test I have when I'm deciding if I like character generation in a game is to try to create Fofford and the Grey Mouser using the rules as written.
I will put my game up against, you know, pretty much other than the ones that are specifically dedicated to that, you know, to that intellectual property. But I could easily run a Fofford and the Grey Mouser type game with Eyes Beyond the Torchlight. I think it's one of Scott's, there's no Appendix N listed in the book, but I think it would be there. Had he included one?
Yeah, I got a very kind of sword and sandal, kind of Fafnir and Grey Mouser or Conan kind of vibe from a lot of the artwork, but also kind of the setting to a degree.
Definitely one of Scott's favorite subgenres. As a matter of fact, several of his other projects have been very much pursuing that. We're taking out like the, you know, the elves and the dwarves and the halflings, and making it more human centric, making it, taking out the clerics, you know. Sword and sorcery is a major interest of his and mine.
Very cool.
Oh, another thing I wanted to make sure that I mentioned is that if you're curious, if you go to the game's entry in our page on DriveThruRPG, they have an option for a large size preview. You can preview the first 100 pages of the game. That's something that Scott did before me, and I honored that tradition of, like, under the my company, the Max HP, that's what we call ourselves. We also offer that. So that's essentially, if you think about that as being like the player's handbook, it has all of character creation, it has all of the power spells, it has all of, you know, basically how to play the game. The only thing it does not have in that preview is the monsters, the GM stuff, the setting, and the introductory adventure. But for $9.99, that can all be yours too.
Very cool. That's really generous.
Sorry for the plug.
So I'd like to move on to the part of the show where we talk about our favorite things.
Absolutely.
About the game. So I have a big one and a little one. So I'm going to start with a little one. As I'm looking in the ancestries, under Dwarf, always one of my favorite fantasy races, Monty Hauler. You can carry 10 additional items with or without a backpack. See encumbrance, page 88. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I really like that. And then the big picture thing that I would like to say that I really like about this game is that it's so complete in a 218-page book. It's not like there's glaring omissions. It's enough for you to do almost anything you would want to do with a role-playing game. I mean, it doesn't have the minutia of AD&D, but it also doesn't have a lot of the vagueness of basic D&D, you know?
Yeah.
So it's almost like Goldilocks finding the bed that's just right, you know, as far as a self-contained game.
I could not agree more. That's why I bought it.
So, James, do you have a favorite thing you've seen so far?
It's going to be hard to get it to just two. One of the things I'll combine, which is my normal take, which is I love the form factor. So when you say 218 pages, it's 218 pages of digest size.
Yep.
And the font is fairly large, so my old eyes can see it.
I can read it without my my readers. So yeah, that was nice too.
Yeah, so it's you know, not a lot of space there, and it's not like the words were shoved in there. The writing is you can tell the writing is good quality because he's accomplished a very complete system with very like small amounts of text. And I really appreciate that about it. The layout is good. I like the title font used and bolded fonts to draw attention. Very, very, very good. And then to kind of like hit home, my favorite thing by far is the monster stat block. Sure. It is a single row of the major stats. It's in a table format, and the table headings are striped from dark to light. So it's very easy to read at a glance, and still manages to give almost every single monster traits that make them unique. So it's not, you know, simple stats and monsters are basically samey. Each monster is very unique, and as Rick said, it would fit on an index card if not a business card. So I really like that.
What about you, Rick? Do you have a favorite thing you would like to pinpoint?
Everything. no, I think my favorite thing is how easy it is to adapt on the fly. I can take any AD&D module, any D&D modules. Matter of fact, the time that we played, Todd, that was a 5e module that I took, and just without really any preparation, just ran it. We had a 4-hour session, and it's so easy just to eyeball and say, okay, well, this is how this works in Eyes Beyond the Torchlight. So, and just on the fly. It's just infinitely easy to hack and to modify. So if there's something that you've heard tonight and it's like, ooh, I don't like when player facing rolls, or I don't like, you know, as a GM, I love to roll dice. I want to roll dice. Well, that's super simple to do or to change really with no effort whatsoever. But I just recommend trying it, you know, as intended, at least once. And yeah, if you don't like it, change it. You know, there's no game police here. None at all. Scott was huge on that. And I thoroughly agree with him. You know, if you want to change that, or if you want to, like, I don't like the fact that they combine strength and constitution into one score. Well, change it so that it's like the classic D&D scores, strength, dexterity, constitution, you know, all those. And it's not going to be hard to do at all. As a matter of fact, it was done before like that in the past. It was an earlier edition, an unrevised edition that did exactly that.
Which we figured out, my PDF that I have has the 6 stats on it. So yep. I have to get a newer one.
I'll take care of you. I'll make you a deal.
Okay. So the ultra rare limited edition box set that I haven't taken out of the shrink wrap yet. Does it have the 6 stats?
It does, I believe. I have open mind, but you know, I'm trying to. It's not only broken up into six additional stats; it's an additional rule book. So the box set features four rule books, like 60-page rule books, rather than one volume. So like all the character creation rules are in one volume, all the monsters are in another. And it's sort of like, you know, the whole like classic brown box, white box format, but on super, super nice paper and with glossy covers.
So I did get to see.
They're unfortunately no longer available unless you know me really, really well.
So if somebody finds one of these out in the wild, they really should grab it.
Yeah. I think it's a hell. I mean, I know I'm biased. But even before I bought the game, I couldn't believe that Scott was willing to do that sort of work and that sort of spend that kind of money. It came with a pencil. It had like it had dice. It had everything that you would think. It had a little GM screen in it, and you know, it's an amazing box set. And he was practically giving them away. I think they retailed for like $40. He only made 50 of them, and they're numbered, by the way. And
mine is number 40.
Number 40, yeah.
So I got to see inside of one the other day. So I was over at Trevor, Tales of the Smoking Worm, Trevor.
Did he get one?
Yeah, he's got one.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So his, and I'm pretty sure his number's lower than mine. well, didn't we get like the last 10 or something, Rick?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got, I don't want to brag, but I've got the prototype. So mine is actually marked as being the prototype. Now mine did not come with the GM screen because they were not ready for the prototype, but obviously I got a GM screen in the meantime that I've added to it.
There is amazing stuff inside that box.
I've got the prototype and I've got number 50.
So, Rick, are you ready for your toughest question of the day?
You bet, man. Shoot.
What don't you like about this game?
I guess one thing that, and probably after we cut from recording, I should have said that too. But one thing I'll say is like the game assumes a couple things. It assumes that you've had access to other forms of, like, say, Dungeons and Dragons or another role-playing game. Like, for example, with the monsters, as many as there are and as concise as the stat blocks, which, you know, I totally agree with James, is a great, great thing. It has almost no descriptive material. So where some like remember in second edition AD&D where they got into the ecology stuff?
Yeah.
And like, you know, all that, none of that is there. So you're going to almost by default have to have access, be it, you know, a print copy, you know, your Uncle Steve's copy, a PDF copy of a monster manual from almost any other Dungeons and Dragons game. And so if you're not sure what a Kushi is, you know, just look it up in that monster manual and you say, oh, okay. So, I mean, there's a small description, so
it does give you appearance.
It gives you the very basics, but you're not going to get that, say, that AD&D second edition level of details and so forth. So that's minor, but that's a thing.
That's fair.
Oh, and I'm also pissed off that I didn't think of it before Scott.
What about you, James? Have you spotted something you don't like?
Don't hold back, guys.
This is hard because I, so far, everything I've seen, I've really liked. The only thing I might like is, in keeping with my normal kind of things to point out, there are a lot of places in the book where you have to pick between two things, whether it's in a spell or a, you know, different places, they'll have this or this. The spacing between The first thing and the second thing and the ore is not consistent, and it drew my eye very quickly. And it's such a nifty thing.
That one I have not heard yet. So that's that. We'll have to put that in the notes for like a revise. That one I have not been brought to my attention yet.
It's so picky, and I feel like it's such nitpicky. So that's the only thing that, you know, has stood out, which says a lot. Like, this is a really good rules light game that I could just like pick a dungeon up and run it.
Yes.
And I really love that. The only thing I think maybe I might change a little bit of, and it's not like change, I would be add, is the armor class. I might add like a Morkborg style, like damaging shields, kind of.
Yeah, armor is not technically armor class. Armor is DR. So if you have light armor, like if you have leather armor, you probably have like your armor is rated 1. And so that means each and every time that you would take damage, you get to subtract 1 from it because your armor absorbs that. It goes up to like the heaviest of armor, like plate mail armor, having a rating of 3. So with every damage, you know, you get to subtract 3. And if that brings it down to 0, then you take no damage whatsoever. There are some edges and obviously magic items that can bring it up as much as a 4. There's also an alternate rule that's presented. Like if you don't like the idea of like a successful hit, not doing any damage at all, you could make it where, you know, it's assumed that any hit, no matter what, even if it normally be reduced to 0 or less, does at least 1 point of damage.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to make sure. Because we really haven't talked about that, so
yeah, I love how hackable it is. Because I'm already
extremely
looking at like what would I change? I would change maybe the XP system to include, and maybe there's a rule and I haven't seen it because there's all kinds of optional rules, to include like so much gold value equaling 1 point of
That really is not reflected now, but that would be really simple to add.
Yeah.
So I have a couple dislikes I'd like to bring up. One is there's no index. So it's over 200 pages, and there is an okay table of contents. But at over 200 pages, I would either like to see an index or just a little more of a breakdown in the table of contents. Because, you know, the table of contents got me close to where I needed to be. But since, you know, I'm not super familiar with the book, you know, I would have to scroll down through or flip through, find exactly what I was looking for.
That's a fair point.
Like, yeah. So like in the character creation, in the table of contents, if there was an additional line that said ancestries on this page, archetypes start on this page, just that much of a breakdown, I think would be very beneficial. And like edges and hindrances, it says page 66. Couldn't we have edges and hindrances pages separated? Because then you could quickly jump to the hindrances.
That's a fair point. Now, the PDF, if you choose to get it on PDF, what they call it, not the bookmarks, but when you can kind of like look at it page by page and quickly click on it
so
that it takes you to any page, that is very detailed.
Right.
Scott did an amazing job on that. So you can hop. And then, of course, you can put in your own bookmarks. So you, you know, but the pages where you can just simply, you know, not hyperlinks because it's not hyperlinked, but just, you know, I'm not like really a design guy, so I don't know what to call it. But I know that I on my iPad, I can simply click the little like you know, pages icon and like look at a list, you know, that I have to scroll down and like, oh, okay, so there's edges, there's powers, there's monsters, you know, that kind of thing. It's very detailed.
So my other thing, which in a way is a bigger deal, but an easier fix. And I'm actually pretty sure you're working on this. Can we get an official character sheet?
Oh. Yeah. The character sheet is slightly out of date. So of course, you know, I offer them for free. I've got them on the, I have a Facebook page for the game. It's Eyes Beyond the Torchlight. Those are available for free download there. I just got up like the GM cheat sheet, I call it. It's like, think of it as kind of like the insert sheets for your own GM screen.
Oh, yeah.
With those universal GM screens. So you can get those. It's a pay what you want on drive-through right now. And I do plan to, once I get those, you know, there's just a, I think there's a reference to like a body score in the encumbrance field on the character sheet. And of course the body score is no more. It's now, it should say brawn. But other than that, it's fully up to date. You know, it's fully usable as is. So once I get that minor correction made, I'll get it back up on drive-thru in both a form fillable version, a portrait version, and a landscape version.
Cool, cool.
So to answer your question, absolutely. Well, also, I honored that brick and mortar policy where, you know, if you buy it in print and you'd like the PDF, just reach out to me, Rick Hall on Facebook, or just, you know, if you post, if you want to join the Eyes Beyond the Torchlight fan page, it's not one of those where you get, have to be reviewed to be approved. It's public. So just, you can sign right up for it. You can say, hey, you know, I bought it, you know, can I get the PDF? And I'd be more than happy to shoot you the PDF. Just like I'm going to shoot Todd here an updated PDF for him. Here after we get done recording tonight.
Holy cow, Rick. I just looked in. I have not joined that group yet.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks, Todd. I'll be sure and join your... I have joined the Next Round Games page because I'm just that kind of guy.
I have now officially joined the Eyes Beyond the Torchlight.
All right, cool. Group. I'll make you an admin. So when people ask me a question I can't answer, I was like, let's check with Todd. Todd, what do you think?
Oh,
it's
see,
not, it's not I, one of those I, groups where it's, you're not going to see 10 posts a day, but you know, it's active enough, I think. And there's some good information there. And, you know, if you have a question, it's probably one of the better places to ask. You can also ask in the comments on the drive-through page. You know, but the Facebook is probably best. I'm not on Discord. I'm too old for Discord. I'm very sorry about that. Maybe we can just get James to start a Discord page for it.
I could set that up for sure.
I know you can. I know you can. You're a Discord kind of guy.
I see I'm already way behind the curve on this. Eric Bloat and David Coppoletti and your buddy Ed, they're already...
In other words, my friends, Todd?
Yeah, it's like...
we've been meaning to talk to you, Rick.
Hundreds of people have beat me. Hundreds of people have beaten me to this phase, Rick.
Yeah, well, you're not alone. There's others that haven't, but that's cool. I am not going to, like, you know, I'm sure they could probably point out, like, I don't know if I'm on everybody's page for their games and so forth, so... It's all part of it, but I appreciate anybody that does join. I'd love to answer any questions. I'd love to, like, hear anybody's ideas for, like, future products with it, for changes. If you just want to give me raving, you know, praise, I will accept that as well. But I'll also take, you know, constructive criticism. I'll take non-constructive criticism. You know, it all, I think, helps make the game a better thing. I just can't promise that any of those changes will take place anyway soon. I'd like to sort of, like, you know, just now that it, you know, it was quite a process getting it up in print on both Amazon in hardback and soft cover. But now that it's on there, I'd like to let that ride for a while. But then, you know, the way I am, I'm constantly thinking about any game I get, especially a game that I buy the publishing rights to. Any game I get, I'm thinking, like, what would I have to do to run Star Wars with this? What would I have to do to run superheroes? So you can be dang sure that I have thought of both those things this game. And, you know, of course it's not going to be licensed, but, you know, it'll be pretty obvious what it is if I ever, like, you know, get that ball rolling.
Very cool. If I could throw something else in here for to go to the, like, there is so much in this book. I just flipped through. There is a dungeon in chapter three with 24 rooms on a Dyson map. Like huge for me, like very cool.
Yeah, I think that's the only artwork in the game that is not Scott or public domain is like, they got, of all people, they got a Dyson map in it. So, you know, then there's that too.
Which, of course, is an awesome map.
It is an awesome map. And 25 rooms is near Mega Dungeon. So, like, that's you managed to fit that in there also. That's just how, like,
and besides, like,
system is.
The monster section features, like I said, already over 150 monsters, and then the adventure adds like three more. So, you know, it doesn't like rest on its laurels and like just like look up the stats like presented earlier in the book. It provides stats for three more monsters, so it raises the total even higher. I think that brings it up to like 157 or something like that.
Nice.
That's a heck of a value. That's really cool.
I'd like to think so, but I'm biased.
So normally, late in the show, we ask what you would steal from a game, but you took it upon yourself to actually buy the whole game instead of just stealing part of it.
Yeah.
So,
I wasn't happy with, like, you know, just, you know, I had to have the full thing. That's just, you know, my kind of, my nature.
The full Monty.
Yep. But then again, I've been, you know, where Scott had his influence, I definitely have mine as well. DCC being a huge one. So I've got some house rules in the works that are very much, you know, if you're familiar with DCC, you would definitely recognize where they came from.
I have played DCC one or two or 300 times, I think.
I believe James this is pretty much in the same boat.
Yes, I am.
The same Viking longship, as it were. You know, to make a Sailors on the Starless Sea reference.
Yes.
I love that you brought that up. I ran a funnel. I ran a DCC funnel using Eyes Beyond the Torchlight, and it worked like a dream. I chose a friend of the show, or at least friend of the podcast host, David Beatty's Carnival of the Damned, and ran it basically I'd run it before, like in DCC, but I just opened it up and we started playing, and it worked like a dream. Just made, you know, a little bit of knowledge of how, if you've played Eyes Beyond the Torchlight once, or if you've read it over and you think you grasp it, you think you rock it pretty good, I think you could do the same.
Nice. So I think we've probably covered about everything. It's about time to bid adieu once again. So, as is par for the course, we will leave with the words of the Good Advice Dwarf: never split the party.
Never shoot into melee, but Eyes Beyond the Torchlight does not have shooting into melee rules. So, but, you know, it'd be dirt simple to add them in there.
And don't split the party unless the party's already split.
I think you missed something. We're going to get killed by a trap, James, because you didn't check for traps. Well, we're all going to die.
I was looking at the rogue section here, and I didn't see.
He went off script. It's okay.
That's okay.
We're gonna get hate mail now, but, you know, it's all right. You know,
make a saving throw versus poison needle, James. And
I'm going to add a D6 to that.
And hopefully... people are going to have to tune in the next time to see if you made your saving throw. Bye.
Hey, good night, everybody.
See ya.